Hello and welcome back. This is Victoria Duda from Zenith Lifestyle. I'm bringing you episode 12 of the Metaphysical Podcast entitled Beyond Imagination, an adventure in time and space with author June Kidd, Silver Ambassador. Today we have a topic that kept coming back in our Metaphysical Podcasts because it is so important in all issues metaphysical. It is the power of imagination. And I believe personally that this is such an important topic because it is not taken seriously these days. How often have you heard maybe the sentence, oh, this was just your imagination? Or we tell children who are maybe talking to their imaginary friends or who make up adventures in their mind that this is just a fairy tale. This is just imagination. But all of us who have studied and learned about the workings of the mind, we know that imagination is actually an incredible power of the universe, which is our own power to create something new. Because with the power of our imagination, we can begin to create a future that is yet to come. And today we are going to talk about this topic in a very special way. I'm very delighted to have author June Kidd here today.
Hello, June.
Hello and welcome. Because June has gone through an incredible adventure when she was writing her book entitled Unshriven. She has begun to write this book as a fiction, but she wasn't just writing it normally, so to speak. She was using the Silva mind control method, and she was meditating each time when she sat down to write a chapter. So the product that came out of this work was a book that turned out to be actually true.
Yes.
So June, if you would be so kind, could you let our audience know a little bit about what was your book about?
Well, first of all, I have to apologize for the squeaky voice. It's hay fever. I've just walked in your lovely garden, smelling your roses, and straightway it attacked my throat. Right. So my introduction to the Silva method, to taking the training, was a turning point in my life. With their training, I learned to control my butterfly mind and focus my imagination. So we'll talk a lot more about Silva later.
Yes.
And in the meantime, I'll briefly tell you what my story was about. So armed with this amazing training, this discipline in meditation, imagination, and mind control, my mind control, by the way, that's a Silva motto. This is Silva mind control, your mind control. You are always in control.
Exactly, not someone else controlling
exactly,
your mind.
Exactly, that's
it's
right.
You who is in power.
They're putting
exactly.
us in the driving seat.
Yes,
that's right,
yes. Yes.
So armed with this incredible training and having had some wonderful experiences, I went back to Saudi Arabia, where I was living at the time, and it was quite a delightful spot because I lived opposite the ocean and there was never anyone around, and every morning I would put my little table out on the patio and I would start to type, and I decided that I would write a story, and in my mind, in my imagination, I set it in 1963, and in my mind I saw these little cottages and a tiny hamlet in England, close to Stratford-on-Avon, that's Shakespeare's country. Mm. And I started to write the story set in 1963 about interweaving relationships in this small community, when quite dramatically 1963 turned to 1663. Mm. It was difficult because I tried to dismiss it, but it would not be dismissed. The story grew stronger, and once my attention had been captivated, it just wouldn't stop. So the 1963 story was put on hold, and I introduced the new subject, the new date, by using one of my characters, Stella, as a clairvoyant. So that made the link between 1663 and 1963. And I started to write, and as I was writing, I was meditating. And the more I wrote, the more I meditated, till I would get to the state every day where I put my fingers on the keys and start to type. And then I would be watching the pictures in my mind's eye, and I would just be reporting what I was seeing. Mm. And I would get to the state where I wouldn't be aware of my body. I was so deeply in the state of meditation. I wouldn't be aware of my body, just what my eyes were seeing and what my fingers were reporting. But in this tiny village, I started to get sounds and smells and emotions, and I could overhear conversations. I must explain, this was never actually in my ear, but in my mind. You know, this
yes,
is a thing.
An inside perception.
Yes, it was inside, yes, but I was there. This technique is taught, isn't it? If you want a new car, then you should go and see it and drive it and hold the wheel and say, I'm going to have it. Well, without intending this, I just found myself doing exactly this. My training with Silver was so good that I didn't notice the backache and the hours that I sat at the typewriter. So I wrote and I wrote, and the story unfolded that there were two sisters who lived in this tiny hamlet. This is 300 years previously, so there were a lot of trees around then. And the elder sister, who was a woman in her round about 20, was a herbalist, and her little sister lived with her. And they were daughters of the mill owner, who was further upstream. And they kept themselves to themselves, and they made potions, and they gave them and sold them to the villagers. That was fine. And then plague struck. It struck on a little tiny hamlet on the hill above, opposite the manor house, and all hell broke loose, as you can well imagine. And there's gossip started to go around that maybe it was one of the sisters, were they witches and not herbalists. So everyone was in fear and panic mode, and I saw a group of people, of men, pushing a young parson, the religious man, down the hill, down this gully, towards the cottages, and they were going to murder the elder sister. Well, they were going to butcher them both if they had a chance. Well, the sister, I saw her mixing a potion for the child. The child took it. It was to make her sleep, and she pushed her into the cold bread oven. It was quite a big oven, the back of the fire. I saw her pushing her in there, and then she drank her own death. She was dragged out later and derped all the things done. And in any case, moving on from that, she was later moved to the churchyard without anyone knowing, because the lord of the manor and the vicar didn't believe that this sister had been a witch. She was a herbalist. So they buried her close to the wall in the churchyard, and the gravestone was there along with others of that period. But they didn't put a name, and they said it was the grave of someone who, a drover who'd been killed on the hills. Drovers used to herd their cattle from as far away as Wales to Lechlade, to have their cattle sent up to their cattle and their geese sent up to London on the barges. So that's where this girl was. This is where the sister was. Now, the surviving little sister who was in the bread oven, she was rescued by the eldest son of the manor, of the lord of the manor, and she was taken across the boundary to another stately home where she grew up as companion to two sisters there, Anna and Apollina Cotton. These names I also got through. Anna and Apollina Cotton, and she was educated alongside them, and she learned to make numbered accounts. So by the time the girls married, this young girl, Hannah, was now a young woman, went to live at the manor, the house owned by the man who had rescued her, who now owned the manor. His father had died. She went there as his housekeeper. Well, she'd seen him lots of times over the years, and she had fallen in love with him. And in fact, he was in love with her. But he was a very honourable man, and he was married. She went as housekeeper, and she went to live in the attics. She had two private rooms in the attics, and then in the long attics where the maids were. So the feeling that I got when I actually found this manor house was that she had stood night after night with her hand on the landing, on the post, ready to go, pretending to go downstairs should anyone find her. But she was listening to sounds from the house below, because this was the time of the Civil War too. And intrigue and secrets, and voices carry up a stairwell.
Yes.
So she knew a lot of information, but she didn't tell it. She spoke it, because if ever she had been detained and threatened, she had some armour, but she kept very quiet. But she waited for him moon on moon to come to her bed, and he didn't ever do that. Why? It was because when he was a young man, he had foolishly because he knew Hannah and her sister, he foolishly called Hannah his little witch of the woods when he used to find her in the woods when she was gathering herbs. Mm. And he was horrified and thought that perhaps it was his loose talking to his friends that had started the rumour that they were witches. So because of this, and because he couldn't tell her for fear of bringing her memory back, she went her whole life through without them actually making love. And so she didn't know until the very end of her life what had happened. But she died most angry, vowing never to go to her sleep, to her rest, until the truth was told and the shame of witchcraft lifted from her family name. So that's basically what the story was about.
What a story in itself, isn't it?
Yes.
If you listen to it as a story, you would really think, yes, that is something that
indeed
a novelist would make
that's
out.
That's right.
And you, while you were writing it, you thought it was your imagination. You thought it was fiction.
Wait, of course.
At the beginning, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yes. When I came out of it, you know, at the end of every day, as I say, forgetting the backache and all the rest of it, I didn't even notice it. When I came out every day, I thought, wow, that's another chapter in this story, this novel.
Yes, yes.
You know, but when I was actually in there, I was living the emotions and the fear and the intrigue of it all.
Yes.
And the heartache as she waited for this man who
I
she
believe
loved.
We should talk about that later a little bit more, mm-hmm. because the fact that you picked up on this story, I think, has to do a lot with the fact that there was so much emotion involved.
Absolutely.
That
very
it was
powerful.
An emotionally extremely charged,
yes.
karmically extremely charged
mm-hmm.
story
mm-hmm.
that was still in the air
yes.
waiting for someone.
Can I tell
to
you
find?
Why I think I told the girl I was sent this story? This is just a by the way.
Yes.
I felt that I needed to come to this earth for a special reason, and I know that reason. And I believe that Hannah Meyer gave up her slot, mm-hmm. if you like, to come to this earth, so that I could come in her place. So, but the condition was that I would tell her story and lift the shame from her family name. Have the shame lifted from her family name
yes.
by getting the church involved.
Yes.
That's why I think I was here, and that's how I picked up on her story.
That is very interesting, yes. So that links us into something that we have spoken about previously in the podcast, is that we have not just the time of our lives and not just the time of a new birth, but we also have time in between, don't
that's right,
we?
That's right.
And in that time, we all have a chance to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have the chance to communicate with each other and plan life missions together.
That's right.
So you had a connected life mission, but what makes it really interesting is that with someone who was born hundreds of years
that's
before
right.
you were
yes,
born.
Yes, that's right.
Yes,
that's
because
right.
in that in-between state, time doesn't matter, does it?
Absolutely yes. not. She was reaching
it's
out across the
it's
centuries
beyond
to me.
Time and space.
Mm.
So this is so extremely interesting. I want to talk more about the metaphysics of it. But first, let us tell our listeners how you came to understand that actually what you wrote was historic fact, not just metaphysical fact, but you could find that that was historically mm. accurate, everything
yes,
that you wrote.
That's right.
How did you bump into that?
Well, remember, I was using the silver method for concentration and the mirror of the mind techniques
yes.
that they use. That was incredibly important. As I say, before I took the silver training, I had a scattered mind. I think about 20 things at once, you know,
yes.
concentrate on very little. This gave me the power of concentration. It put me in the driving seat of my life and of my emotions. So I got focused emotions and focused training because I'd learned meditation and imagination and mind control, remember?
Yes, it is based, isn't it, on slowing down your brainwaves so you get into a relaxed state of mind.
That's right.
Where you do have access to your subconscious.
That's right.
It's very similar to what we do in hypnosis and in self-hypnosis.
Yes, yes.
And then you can access not just your own brain, but your mind and the higher mind
that's
that
right.
connects us all.
Exactly, that's right.
So you were put really perfectly in the driver's seat to pick up on something
that's
that
right.
is beyond your own personal brain. It's beyond your own personal life.
And of course, this was the incredible things that took me, the path that took me to the silver mesh that I'll tell you about later. But it was all designed. It was as though the new universe was one step ahead of me and the universe was deciding where I should go next. But I'll just tell you now that I'd finished the story and then I went back to England and I spent some time in England and then it was time to go back to Saudi Arabia, but for the very first time ever, my visa was delayed. My husband's came through, so he went back, but my visa was delayed. Mm. It never had been delayed before.
So you were meant to stay.
I was meant to stay. That's
yes.
right. So although I grumbled, I was meant to stay. And then I was sitting, I had a house with a garden, with a river at the bottom, which is very restful. And I was sitting and I suddenly, yes, I know how this happened. Mm-hmm. The telephone rang. It was a friend of mine who said, I've joined the Reflexology Society. I said, well, let me come with you. You know, I'm not a member, but I've always wanted to have my toes massaged, rather lovely. So she said, no. But she was very influential in any case. The next night found me in a little place in the Cotswolds, actually. We're back to the Cotswolds. And while I was having my feet massage, it was very good, incidentally. It cleared my sinuses. Someone had been smoking and they cleared yes. instantly. A woman came in, a grey-haired woman, and she sat in the corner of the room with a few people around her, and she had a crystal on her, on a little rope that was doing different movements. So when I'd finished having my treatment, I went over to her and I said to her, you know, we introduced ourselves, and she said, I'm a water diviner. Mm. And she said, everyone can do it, but I think that you would do it very easily. So she said, just sit down. And she gave me this crystal on a little thread and said to me, you just ask it your polarity for yes and no. Well, as soon as I put it above my knee and asked, it almost went horizontal. You know, it was just yes. round, yes. fast moving. So she said, you'd find dowsing, which is, what do they call it, looking for water, easy, why don't you come to my cottage? And she gave me a little tiny map, incredibly detailed, right in the hills, you know, outside of Stratford-on-Avon, deeply written. So I went back, now this is so important, I went back to my place and I sat down on a very old Chesterfield that I had. And I went into meditation and I said, I've met this woman, her name is Beryl, and I like her very much, but she wants me to go to her place to see if we can do this water divining. Now, I like her and I trust her, but I don't want to get mixed up in anything. I actually used the words mumbo jumbo.
Yes.
And then I sat quietly and then the words came to me again, not in my hearing, but silent within my thinking, but very clear. And the words were, go, because not only will this be great fun, but it is important for the time of life you are now coming into. Now,
yes.
Christ, I had to go, didn't
yes,
I?
Yes.
So
yes.
I finally got to Beryl's cottage and I did the water divining. And then, because I didn't know her very well, we had a cup of coffee. And I said, by way of conversation, Beryl, when were these cottages built, do you think? And she said, well, we don't know. We think round about the 1630s, 1640s. I felt as though I'd been hit by a bolt of lightning and my body shook. And not with fear, but there was an energy on
that
me.
That excitement of getting
it
into
it. It was power that was in it. It had just entered my body. And I wasn't afraid at all, you know, not worried at all. It was. And she asked me what was the matter. And I said, I had written a story about somewhere like this, but it can't be here. Because if so, there should be a big fireplace on that wall. And there should be a fireplace with a bread oven. And then in this corner there should be a staircase. And she said, the fireplace and the bread oven are behind that false wall there. And she said, and if you look in the corner, you'll just see the two little steps in the cottage which starts in the place next door. It had been divided, you see.
Yes.
She said, it's next door. So, and then I said, Beryl, are there two steps leading up to a blank wall in your attic? And she said, yes. And then I knew that it wasn't imagination.
Yes.
I'd been directed to this place for
yes,
a reason.
Yes. Yes, that is such an amazing thing.
It was, yes. yes. It shook me.
It seems to me that these things, when they start to happen, because probably every human being in the world gets a sign at one point in
yes.
their lives.
Yes,
and then
they dismiss
things,
it.
Two things can happen. They either dismiss it and then there is no point of continuing.
Yes.
Or they listen to it, and I think that the more they listen to it, the more the signs keep coming, and it becomes a fact of snowball. And that's what you happened. So you were always following it.
That's right. It's intuition. The more you follow it, the stronger it becomes. But when you were talking about imagination, Einstein said, he said, intellect is good, but imagination is better.
Yes.
That's where his words.
Yeah. So, and it's so interesting because I remember even hearing from authors who are not particularly considered as spiritual, like I remember Stephen King. He even said that he doesn't feel like he's making up his stories himself.
That's right. I didn't.
He said that he feels more like an archaeologist who's finding a kind of artifact that he's digging out and he needs to find it. It's a search mission.
Yes.
As opposed to using your own brain to
That's
make
right.
up something.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly how it was. I mean, I didn't go after this story. It came after me. It presented itself
yes.
to me.
So what incredible implications that
had. Absolutely, no? That's right.
Yes.
And then, of course, I started to go around the village to different places in my book, because in my book there are photographs of the barrel and the inside of the cottage, and the photograph of the manor house is concerned. And going into this one manor house where she had, actually it was the manor house where she'd spent her adult life with the man that she loved, the lord of the manor. And in that place, I knew that there were two small rooms at the top that had been hers. But when there had been a fire, and one part of the manor had been gutted. But I went upstairs and I said to myself, they should be here. And I asked my hostess, are the rooms upstairs? She said, no. And I was most disappointed, couldn't understand it. And we went downstairs into the garden, and then I looked up at the roof line. It was all higgledy-piggledy over the centuries, different bits added. And I suddenly said, what's that window? And she said, oh, that's just two little storerooms. We just keep boxes and things in there. So yes. I raced up the stairs, and I went up the stairs, and there, as I'd written it, the one bedroom where she actually slept hadn't got a window, but the other bedroom looked over and up to the village where the plague had started.
Mm.
And so she had spent her life. Incidentally, I must just tell you this, there was no record of that village until a year before I wrote the story. There was a drought and the earth shrank, and an aerial photographer in a small plane went over and snapped the outlines of that small village.
Ah,
there was no record of it, but it was there. The book is full of these amazing details.
Yes, and you found even their graves, didn't you?
I did.
Yes.
This was with the help of Beryl. When I left Beryl, I went to the local churchyard, and so I got my little pendulum, and I stood in the graveyard and I said, is the woman I want to pay my last respects to here? And it went, yes. But I didn't look down at my feet.
Yes.
I just looked out at the churchyard and started going round and going, nothing happened. And then exhausted, I gave up. But it was when
later... You were standing on it.
Yeah. When a month later, when Beryl came back from Wales, and we went to the same place, and she was up by the corner of the manor house. The pictures are in the book, you know, with the gravestones and all that. So I said, Beryl, you know, could you find this woman's grave? So she just held her rods. She just turned round, marched briskly straight to the spot where I'd been standing. And there was this very insignificant looking gravestone with still having decoration around it, but no name.
Yes.
Whereas the ones next to it were of a similar age, but they still had their names clearly defined. So this was the one. And she said, yes, I can tell you how long she is. And she just used her rods. So I'd found that. And that was why at the end of the story, I got the Reverend John Beckett to say prayers over the grave and for the people in that churchyard there who had been involved probably in the murder, because they weren't wicked people. They were terrified. So I had to put that blessing, make peace with everybody.
Yes. This is something that keeps coming back when you do past life regressions.
Yes.
That you make peace with everybody involved.
Yes. Indeed.
And only then the shift occurs.
Yes. Absolutely right. Yes.
And it's very, very therapeutic also to go into the mind of those that did the wrong.
That's right.
Because you will discover that they didn't do it because they were evil.
Yes.
They did it because they were afraid
or uneducated,
or because they believe they're doing actually something good by protecting religion or whatever.
Killing the witch,
you know, protecting God.
Yes. That's
and when these things, I learned that from therapy, that when these things happen, that someone gets to know the mind of the enemies at that time, then a wonderful shift happens, because there is genuine forgiveness.
Yes, the word is to know all is to forgive
all. To forgive all, yes, yes. So did you feel the shift? What happened at the end?
At the end, I came away from the gravestone exhausted, and the only thing that I was sad about, I said, that's complete. It was off my shoulders after all those years. It had been a weight on my shoulders, responsibility. Yeah. And I went away, when I'd first made the journey, it had been March, and I'd seen a lovely big clump of coltsfoot there. It's a tiny yellow flower. It's on the back of the book. And I said, the only sad thing is it's a bit too early for the coltsfoot, and it doesn't grow in my part of the world in the south. It needs dampness and heathland and that kind of thing. So I drove back. And then when I got home, I went out into my little courtyard, and there, in a pot that was waiting to be replanted with geraniums, was a whole blooming crop of coltsfoot. I think I almost wept, and I just looked to the sky, and I wrote, thank you, thank you, Hannah, right across the sky in big letters. And I knew that she had found her peace and she'd gone on.
Yes, yes. I don't know whether you're aware of it, that it's Jung, the psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. He collected quite a lot of cases of that. That he calls synchronicities.
Yes.
That there is a sign coming apparently from nature.
Yeah. That
tells the psyche that some shift is occurring. I think his most famous case was that he was analyzing the dream of a patient who's dreaming with a scarabaeus.
Right.
That is, you know, native mm-hmm. in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And while he was listening to the patient who was lying on the couch, and he was looking out of the window into the garden, and then in flew a bug that was the closest relative to a scarabaeus that exists in our climate, and sat down at his hand, basically.
Amazing, yes.
And I get goose pimples when I'm telling you that, because it's, and people say that when people die and then they see certain birds that are connected with the deceased person or butterflies or whatever, or in your case, a flower.
Yes.
That is it's coming from nature, but it's a word that's coming about the psyche from nature to
that's
you.
Right. That's right, yes. But of course, I couldn't have done any of this without the training.
Yes.
Because I would not have concentrated so much.
Yes. It is an amazing method, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, we were just talking before we started the podcast that I've done this training when I was 14 years old in Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
And in Hungary, it had a huge impact because it was the first spiritual thing that came into the country before or just at the time when communism ended. And it's almost a legend now that Domian, who translated the course from Silva, he had no idea what he was doing. Like, just like you, the story is very similar. He was just following his meditative intuition.
Yes.
And he was told to translate a book, print it of his own costs, put it in the truck of his car, and drive. And he didn't even know where he was driving. And he stopped the car at one of the most popular places in Budapest. I believe it was the Moscow Square at that time. And he just opened the truck and was waiting because he was instructed to do that.
Yes.
Someone stopped and said, "What is that book that you got there?" And he started to describe that this is a way to be more in charge with your mind and to work your mind for your own benefit. And the person said, "Can I get a copy?" And he sold the book within an hour, I think. The whole truckload, it was gone.
Yes.
People took it like the proverbial sugar.
Mm.
And then it became big, and I was 14 years old when I've done it, and there was very much contradiction about it. I remember in school we were told not to do it because it was something
yes.
too weird. But a lot of people did it. I think in Hungary you have 10%, if I'm well informed, of the entire population.
I must be convinced because my grandchildren have
taken it as well.
Yes.
So what effect did it have on your life apart from the book?
Apart from the book... it has affected every part of my life for the better, I might add. So, but the intriguing part was when I actually came to take the Silver Method, that I was living in Saudi Arabia, and I was sending healing messages, healing thoughts, healing prayers to a couple of friends who were very ill in this country. I was making myself wake up at about 4 o'clock in the morning, which was like 2 o'clock UK time, to send healing messages. But the problem was I couldn't get back to sleep again, and I became exhausted. And this one morning, I looked up and I said, "I can do this no longer. I want help." Now, remember this, because this is the whole point. When you totally say something and you believe it and you expect it to happen, right?
Yeah.
It will happen. It says in the Bible so many times, "Whatsoever ye pray for, believe ye have it and you have it." Now, it is our right, our birthright. We can connect to this world. So I demanded it. I wanted help. It was important. And then an English woman who had married an Australian and had married an Egyptian, she'd moved to Australia. They came to Saudi Arabia to our hospital, and just hours after I had made the statement, there was a knock on my door, and it was this wonderful woman called Jennifer, and I found myself explaining to her why I was so tired, and she said, "You need the Silver Method. That's what you should do. You can do absent healing, and you feel wonderful." Well, you know, sometimes fate is one step ahead of you, because I had the week before, I had one a raffle ticket home. I put my hand in this hat and this one felt differently, and I pulled it out. It was my ticket, so I was due to go home. So I went home and I phoned a friend of mine who had said had taken the Silver Method, and she said, yes, it's changed my life, it's wonderful, and there is another course this coming weekend in London. Would you like to go? I thought, would I like to go? Mm-hmm. You know, it was all laid on for me. And I found myself signing up because it wasn't a company that was after lining its pockets every month with your money. This is sort of a one-off fee that you paid for 4 days intensive training, and it was a one-off fee. And after that, you could go for the rest of your life anywhere in the world just for a nominal signing in fee. So in those days, it was four days, but I believe it's three now because people are more accepting now. People are more accepting. So,
yes, because when I did the course first, I mean, maybe we tell the listeners to us who are not familiar with the Silver Method that it is very strongly based on visualization, which is today something that many people teach in different ways. Mm. Like what you just said, if you want something, then you visualize it. Visualizing meaning that you don't just see it in your mind, but you feel it, you hear it, you involve all your senses, you make it as if it was already there. Mm.
And then give thanks.
And then you give thanks because you say it's already there.
That's
you,
right.
You already take it as a fact. And you send that out into the universe to attract everything into your life, which can be, I think, seen psychologically. You know, if you set your mind very focused on one thing, then after that, when you go out into the world, you will be tuned in to find the data.
Of course, yes.
That you need in order to make that reality. Yes. But it's also metaphysically true because you're tuning into that vibration of that thing that
That's
you
right.
want and you align yourself with it.
Well, the thing that at the very end of that training, that 4 day training, the very last day was the amazing thing because a room full of students who were really by this time hyped. But incidentally, the very first thing I learned was to put myself back to sleep. That was the first thing, the first day. Mm. I woke up in the night and I put myself back to sleep instantly. But the last day, we were just given the name of a person, say John Smith, and the age and the location. And we were told that there was a boy. And he was in Florida and his age was 12. So, you know, that's what we were given. And we all closed.
The distant healing exercise.
Distant healing, yes. He was in Florida. Mm. So we went down to our level just to think about this. And I saw this boy walking toward me. And as he walked along the sand, his it would be his right leg, it was left to me, but his right leg was shimmering from the hip down to the foot. Now, when we all came out of our meditative level, the instructor, Paul Francella, asked what we'd seen, and so many people saw the same or variations of the same thing. It was just mind-blowingly amazing. And this is the power. The mind, the imagination, this ability that we have to tune in doesn't recognize boundaries. It doesn't recognize states or cutoff points. It's just a worldwide thing, and then it becomes a spiritual thing. So you move from earthly things that you touch and feel, and you try to help and heal somebody.
Okay. So everybody saw the boy
with a shimmer.
With a shimmer.
Yes.
And because I remember you said that told me that. So what was the outcome then?
Well, it was sheer amazement, but then we had to go
because the boy didn't have legs, no.
The boy had this high hip amputation.
Amputation, exactly.
Because when he was 2 years old. Yes. So
you didn't even know what you were seeing.
No,
but then
the amazing thing is that the leg was still there in a spiritual form.
It's very very interesting because when I did the course after that, I had a very similar experience because my own uncle went to hospital. So I asked someone who did the silver course to do some healing on him. And this friend of mine said, I don't know why, but I only see some kind of shimmer. I don't see a person. I don't see what I normally see. It's only like a light.
Yes.
And neither of us knew by that time, but my uncle died in the meantime.
Oh, right.
So it was the same thing. You know, you see something, but it's a gap because physically it's there, no longer there.
No. But the other amazing things that had happened was that when I was going back home, I put my hand. My eye was suddenly hurting very badly,
right,
really badly, and I tried to sort of press it and ease it off. It wouldn't work. I finally got home. It was about midnight. I wasn't registered with a doctor. My husband was back in Saudi Arabia. So I called my friend who'd taken the course before me, with me, and I said to her, I'm hurt and I'm frightened. And she said, I can hear you. I'll meet you at your level. Well, you know, we are taught a special level, aren't we? A special place to go where we can do our healing. So I went to this special place.
It's a state of the mind.
It's a state of mind, but it's also a place in the state of the mind.
That you visualize.
Yes, you visualize. Yes. And so I went there and I did what I thought I had to do. And I did a healing on my eye, doesn't matter how. But I put my hand over my eye in that spiritual context and also physically here. Mm. And I kept it there. And it might have been 2 or 3 minutes. It might have been 5. I don't know. But after a while, I heard this tapping. And it was tapping. Mm-hmm. I felt it all over my eye. And when the tapping stopped, it was healed. Now, years later, Jose himself came over to London and he said, I have made a sound that works directly on the body's immune system. And he switched it on and it was this.
The same.
And I almost fell off my chair.
Wow.
That the other wonderful things that have happened to me was that living in the Middle East, I'd moved to another area. I had moved to Riyadh and we had friends coming. I lived in a huge block of flats. It was all very luxurious and lovely. And the concierge phoned and said, your guests are on their way, madam. So I was in the kitchen. Rushed it to put the kettle on, spilled some water on the floor. I had new shoes on the tiles, and my feet went slam underneath. I fell forward, and I smacked my head on the door jamb. Now, I saw stars, and my guests were coming up in the lift, and this British stiff upper lip type thing, you know. So I just pulled myself together, went immediately into silver mode, and I said, body, heal yourself, body, heal yourself, body, heal yourself, 3 times. And then I just did what I had to do, and then it was gone.
Gone, yeah.
The doorbell went, and I didn't even think about it.
Yes.
Then the next day, I just touched my temple a little bit, and there was a tiny little bruise in there, but nothing else.
Yes.
And do we have time for another couple of these things?
Yes, let's give one more.
Okay,
yes.
One more. I was on our boat in France, and I was writing, and it was a bit of a rainy day, and then we were pulling into port, and my husband said, would you come and take the lines? So I didn't change my shoes, got up, and it had been raining again, and I jumped off the boat onto the pontoon, smack again, and I crashed down. My legs went either side of the pontoon, and I was really hot. It was a really hot thud through my body. Mm. I immediately went into silver mode again. I went through my body. There was nothing broken, nothing really damaged, just shock. I said to my body, okay, this is just shock. There's no need to send any more shock waves because I know what's happened and we're okay. My husband got off the boat and helped me up and I lay down in the cabin there and I said to him, feel my pulse. And he felt my pulse and it was steady, totally steady. Mm. Within a couple of minutes as it happened.
Yeah.
And then I saw my legs were bleeding. So I started to concentrate on my legs, putting my hands over my legs. And the bleeding just stopped. My legs were grazed right from top to bottom. And just the bottom where I damaged it very badly. And I worked on that and I worked on that and worked on that. And I never had a scar.
So it is.
It is powerful.
It is,
and
powerful,
of course, this has been going since the middle 60s. You see, it's there for a long time. It's nothing new. This man was a scientist and a researcher.
But what gives me the greatest hope from our conversation today is when you said that it is becoming more and more accepted.
Yes, of course.
That whatever sounded so exotic in the 60s, you know, even things like, I remember saying that stress causes illness was like unheard of in the 60s,
yes.
You know, and
you know it.
Dr. Herbert Benson, who said that first, I think he was like almost suspended, you know, and now this is like common knowledge.
Yes.
And all these things are becoming more and more common knowledge, mm-hmm. Which gives me really great hope. And every conversation that we're having like that and every shared story is only helping other people to accept that.
Exactly, of course
it is. It was our previous podcast where I was telling a similar healing story of my own experience. And I was saying I was almost scared because it was so powerful.
Mm.
Because it puts everything upside down that you learned in school. And sometimes people, I think, they don't apply it because it is so putting them out of their comfort zone so much.
That's right.
So the more we talk about it, the more we share these experiences, mm-hmm. the more they become common knowledge, and then everybody can use it.
That's right. And we should develop our own power. That's
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And not be afraid of that.
That's right. I'm reissuing the book, Unshriven. It is still the original form, Unshriven. It is still available on Kindle and Kobo and on Lulu. But also, if you go to my website that you will talk about later, but I'm also issuing just the silver part, the amazing things that happened to me when I went to silver and how I was guided to silver. I'm issuing that in English and in Hungarian.
I'm sure in Hungary they will love it.
Yes.
Yes. And what we are going to do is we are going to put on the Zenith website, the links to your website, mm-hmm. and the links to the book itself.
Yes.
So everybody who wants to learn more about the things and read your book,
yes,
can do so.
Yes.
And as it was for me, I believe it will be quite a life-changing and paradigm-shifting experience to everybody. So thank you very, very much for coming today. Mm-hmm. And I hope you will be back another time
Talk
to us more.
So much more to talk about.
Great. So
incidentally, the new book is called Life Enriched by the Silver Method.
Silver Method. Yes. Fantastic. So we're really looking forward to it. Thank you so much for coming.
My great pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. And talk to you more, hopefully, another time.
When my voice is better.
Oh, definitely. Bye-bye. Thank you so much for listening.